Okay, this is our last time in the book of Judges for a while anyway. This is the last text that we're looking at. However, Judges will make a reappearance in a few months when we look at the epic. We'll look at how Judges fits into the overall story of the Bible. So I will save some of my concluding remarks and for that time. For now, we have one more text to deal with, and I'm looking forward to this morning. As I've enjoyed the entire series in the book of Judges, enjoy might be the wrong word because it's a very challenging text, but I've enjoyed being challenged by the book of Judges, and I hope you have enjoyed it too, at least from that aspect, to emphasize our need for Christ, because that's what the book of Judges does as a whole. It emphasizes our need for Christ. And along those lines, we're going to have a time of life together after our service today when we can share with one another, open our hearts to one another. And our opening question is going to be, how have you sensed your need for Christ? So you might be thinking about that question as the sermon progresses and our time together progresses, about how you might answer that question or address that question and share your life with the rest of us and bless us along those lines. But our time together will not be limited to that question. That's just our opening question. Years ago, when I was involved with junior high kids, there was a few boys in particular I took out golfing, and they were just learning how to golf. And if you've played golf at all, you know that the ball often does not go where you're aiming. This is especially true for junior high boys who are just learning how to play the game. One particular boy, he would take a mighty swing oftentimes and miss entirely. So not only did it not go where he was aiming, he would miss the ball. On one such occasion, he took a mighty cut, and he missed the ball, and he was frustrated. So he drew his club back very quickly in frustration, and guess what happened? He hit the ball, and it went obviously in the wrong direction. In fact, he connected with that ball perfectly, and it went about 50 yards backwards. So in golf, here's how that works, okay? You try to hit the ball, that's one stroke. You actually do hit the ball, that's two strokes, and you're in worse shape 50 yards back. And I thought, even at the time, isn't that a metaphor for life? We find ourselves in some sort of predicament, we respond to that predicament, and our response actually gets us in worse shape. Well, let's look at Judges chapter 21, but before we do, let's look at all of Judges chapter 19 to 21 to get the flavor for the background of this. So again, I have to revisit this difficult story because this is a continuation of the story that began back in Judges chapter 19. There was a Levite, a man from the Israelite tribe of Levi. He had a woman. He took this woman with him to the town of Gibeah, which belonged to the tribe of Benjamin in Israel. And these particular men from the tribe of Benjamin in Gibeah wanted to rape him, but instead, what does he do? He throws his woman to these wolfish men. They rape her, they abuse her, they leave her for dead. The man responds by cutting her up into 12 pieces, sending her out throughout the tribes of Israel. Israel takes umbrage. They're offended by what's happened. They say, we have to do something about this. They take their case to the Benjamites, and this war ensues, this awful war. Eventually, the Israelites as a whole get the best of it. They crush the Benjamites and leave them with only 600 men. They've destroyed everybody, but 600 fugitives have managed to escape to this rock of Rimmon, and that's where we pick up the story. And in Judges chapter 21, the Israelites now have to figure out how to respond to this problem they've created with only 600 Benjamites when they want the tribe of Benjamin to continue. And their solutions to the problem actually create a worse mess. And this is what we as humans have done, isn't it? We've created a mess. We've got problems, we come up with solutions to the problems, and ultimately we usually come up with some sort of worse mess. And we ask ourselves, especially at the end of Judges, is there any hope for us? Is there any hope for humanity? And where might we find that hope? Because this is such a mess. Really, if you look around the world, you have to say, the world is a mess. Let's look at Judges chapter 21. First of all, verses 1 through 4. The men of Israel had taken an oath at Mizpah, not one of us will give his daughter in marriage to a Benjamite. The people went to Bethel, where they sat before God until evening, raising their voices and weeping bitterly. O Lord, the God of Israel, they cried, why has this happened to Israel? Why should one tribe be missing from Israel today? Early the next day, the people built an altar and presented burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. So what the narrator does, he gives us a few more details, some things he has skipped over from earlier in the book of Judges. Now, we understand that there was this gathering at Mizpah. That's when this problem first emerged, that they found out about the problem of Gibeah, the rape of Gibeah. There was this meeting of all of Israel in the town of Mizpah, and they say, okay, what are we going to do about this? Now we find out that they had taken an oath not to give their daughters in marriage to any of the Benjamites. This was in order to rally the troops, in order to let everybody know that this was a serious problem, so they all took this oath not to give their daughters in marriage to the Benjamites, which creates a problem. If there are only 600 male Benjamites left, how is the tribe of Benjamin to continue? And so the Israelites weep for what has happened. They weep for what they have done. They have taken things too far. They have crushed the Benjamites when they didn't need to do all of that. They treated the Benjamites, their brothers, as if they were pagans. And so they end up weeping. They weep for their loss. But here's the important thing to note. They don't weep for their sin. They weep for their loss, but they don't weep for their sin. In fact, they seem to all but blame God for this problem. Why has it come about, O Lord, that this is the case in Israel, that a tribe should not be existent anymore? How has this happened? Well, the answer to that question is easy enough. You go all the way back to what the Levite did. You go back to what the men of Gibeah did. You go back to what all of Benjamin did. You go back to what all of Israel did in response to all of this and created this awful war. It's all because of sin. It's all because of sin and the response to sin and the response to sin and the multiplication of sin. That's how they got into this mess. However, they find a way to more or less shift the blame onto God. I find in my own life that when something goes wrong, not according to my agenda, oftentimes I immediately look for somebody to blame. Somebody must be at fault for this. Things are not going the way I expect them to go. But after a while, usually, after I think about things objectively, I conclude with Jimmy Buffett, who wastes away again in Margaritaville for a long time wondering if his predicament could be blamed on somebody else, but eventually concludes by the end of the song, "It's my own darn fault." Darn fault. And that's the conclusion I often come to, but I have to fight the tendency in myself to blame somebody else. And by the way, I don't waste away again in Margaritaville, okay? Just to be clear about that. That's what Jimmy Buffett does. I don't do that, but I resonate with the song. So the Israelites now, they blame God. They shift the blame from themselves to someone else. Now, how are they themselves going to address this problem? Judges chapter 21, verse 5. Then the Israelites asked, "Who from all the tribes of Israel has failed to assemble before the Lord? For they had taken a solemn oath that anyone who failed to assemble before the Lord at Mizpah should certainly be put to death. Now the Israelites grieved for their brothers, the Benjamites. Today one tribe is cut off from Israel," they said. "How can we provide wives for those who are left, since we have taken an oath by the Lord not to give them any of our daughters in marriage?" Then they asked, "Which one of the tribes of Israel failed to assemble before the Lord at Mizpah?" They discovered that no one from Jabesh-Gilead had come to the camp for the assembly. For when they counted the people, they found that none of the people of Jabesh-Gilead were there. So the assembly sent 12,000 fighting men with instructions to go to Jabesh-Gilead and put to the sword those living there, including the women and children. "This is what you are to do," they said. "Kill every male and every woman who is not a virgin." They found among the people living in Jabesh-Gilead 400 young women who had never slept with a man, and they took them to the camp at Shiloh in Canaan. Then the whole assembly sent an offer of peace to the Benjamites at the rock of Rimmon. So the Benjamites returned at that time and were given the women of Jabesh-Gilead who had been spared. But there were not enough for all of them. So, first of all, there was this oath that they had taken not to give any of their daughters in marriage to the Benjamites. Now we find out that there was also another oath, a so-called solemn oath, regarding this assembly in Mizpah in the first place, that if anybody didn't attend this assembly, they would be put to death. Again, this was in the interest of rallying the troops and emphasizing how serious this issue was. If you don't come to this assembly, you are going to be put to death. And they took an oath to do that. So now what do? They kind of canvass all of Israel, and they discern that there is one particular city east of the Jordan River, Jabesh-Gilead, and those people did not attend this assembly. So they come up with this ingenious solution. They find out a way to keep one oath, that being the oath not to give their daughters in marriage to the Benjamites. They find a way to keep that by exploiting this other oath, the so-called solemn oath, to kill everyone who did not attend the assembly in the first place. However, they find a way to make an exception to the solemn oath, and they find out a way that, we're just going to kill everybody, but we're going to save these particular virgins. If there's a virgin among them, we're going to save the virgins because we need, after all, wives for the Benjamites. So there's an exception, I guess, to the oath, but who can be bothered with technicalities? Really, all of a bother, so we don't have to worry about technicalities. We're just going to forget about all of that. And then, what about the giving of their daughters? Well, they're not actually giving their daughters in marriage to the Benjamites. They will be giving other people's daughters in marriage to the Benjamites. So some technicalities, I guess, once you think about it, are worth the bother. You can really think about that and understand that, you prefer some technicalities and you don't like others. Now let's think about what's going on here. How did this all begin? There was one particular man, a Levite. He seized his woman, and he threw his woman to certain men of Benjamin who raped her. And now we have the Israelites as a whole. What are they doing? They are seizing 400 virgins, 400 women, and giving them to the Benjamites. It looks to me as if they're making the problem worse. And not only that, there is also a shortfall. There are 600 men. There are only 400 women to go around. We have a 200-woman shortfall. What are they going to do about that? Okay, so we come up with our ingenious solutions to our problems as well, don't we? Often sinful solutions. We get into some particular predicament because of sin, and then we try to work our way out of it with sinful solutions to the problems that we have created. And in doing so, we conveniently remember some technicalities and forget others. We are sticklers for some laws, but we are dismissive of others. We really like certain laws, we uphold those, but we dismiss those that we don't like in order to advance our purposes. We find ways to condemn sin in others, like the Israelites, who condemned the sin of the Benjamites, who raped this particular woman, but we find ways to absolve ourselves of sin, just like the Israelites, who abducted 400 women, but said, I guess that's okay. That's all according to the law. That's all according to these oaths that we have concocted. In this way, the people of Israel, and also we ourselves at times, are like the Pharisees that Jesus condemned. Jesus said of the Pharisees that they are really interested in certain laws, certain sort of minor laws. They are very interested in tithing their spices and giving their spices to the Lord, but they are very much interested in ignoring what Jesus called the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. And oftentimes, like the Israelites, our solutions to the problem that we have are incomplete. There's often a shortfall, so to speak. Our solutions don't really ultimately solve the problem. What then do we do? Well, let's see what the Israelites do. Verse 15. The people grieved for Benjamin because the Lord had made a gap in the tribes of Israel. And the elders of the assembly said, with the women of Benjamin destroyed, how shall we provide wives for the men who are left? The Benjamite survivors must have heirs, they said, so that a tribe of Israel will not be wiped out. We can't give them our daughters as wives, since we Israelites have taken this oath. Cursed be anyone who gives a wife to a Benjamite. But look, there is the annual festival of the Lord in Shiloh to the north of Bethel and east of the road that goes from Bethel to Shechem and to the south of Lebanah. So they instructed the Benjamites, saying, go and hide in the vineyards and watch. When the girls of Shiloh come out to join in the dancing, then rush from the vineyards, and each of you seize a wife from the girls of Shiloh and go to the land of Benjamin. When the fathers or brothers complain to us, we will say to them, do us a kindness by helping them, because we did not get wives for them during the war, and you are innocent since you did not give your daughters to them. So that is what the Benjamites did. While the girls were dancing, each man caught one and carried her off to be his wife. Then they returned to their inheritance and rebuilt the towns and settled in them. At that time, the Israelites left that place and went home to their tribes and clans, each to his own inheritance. So now they figure out that there is this particular festival in Shiloh to the Lord, and they are aware that some women come dancing to this festival, worshiping the Lord, celebrating the Lord in some particular manner. And so what they concoct now, the solution, this is what they figure out. Okay, let's just get the Benjamites to lay in wait for these women and catch them as they're going off to worship the Lord. Let's have them catch these women, and then these Benjamites can have the wives that they need. But what about the oath not to give women in marriage to the Benjamites? What about that oath? Well, they're not actually giving their women, are they? Are they doing that? They are giving other people's women. They're giving the people of Shiloh. It's them that are giving it. But actually, aren't the people of Shiloh then giving their women in marriage? No, actually, technically, they're not. They are allowing their women to be taken. You see, there's a difference between giving and allowing to take. See how they can exploit all sorts of technicalities and differences to achieve their ends. So the Israelites are ingenious. Once again, they find loopholes. They can find loopholes in the loopholes. Let's back up again and look at the whole story. In Judges 19, some men of Benjamin violated one woman. In Judges chapter 21, because of the solution of the Israelites, 600 men of Benjamin violate 600 women. Some solution, huh? It makes the problem a lot worse. It's amazing how brilliant we can be when it comes to sin. Sin actually makes you very smart, makes you very brilliant. How you can think about things, how you can think about solving problems. It's amazing once sin gets into the picture, how you can solve a problem and how clear it becomes to you, but actually it makes things worse. But we really are quite ingenious when it comes to coming up with sinful solutions to our problems. We find ways to get around promises. We too, like the Israelites, can find loopholes in the loopholes, all along ignoring the fact that we are creating more problems, hurting more people, and dishonoring God. We weep for our loss, but not for our sin. We tend to blame others. We find sinful solutions to our problems that actually create more problems. This is the world that we live in, isn't it? It's a mess. It's the world we live in. Consider the case of Melky Cabrera, an outfielder for the San Francisco Giants. He tested positive recently for performance-enhancing drugs. And if you're an athlete, what's the common excuse for testing positive? Well, I took this substance inadvertently. I bought and consumed some sort of nutritional product, and I did not know that it was laced with this one particular illegal substance. That's the usual excuse. That's the one that Melky Cabrera was apparently preparing to make. And however, it takes a bizarre twist at this particular point because he has an associate who for $10,000 buys a website which offers a nutritional product. But all along, this was a bogus website. This was a bogus product. It didn't exist. It all existed for the sake of Melky Cabrera being able to say, I bought this particular product that was laced with this substance. I didn't know it included that substance, but all along, the product never even existed. Now, I could understand sensing the need to do something like this if you were playing for the Dodgers. That was for you, David. But if he's playing for the Giants, then why would... it doesn't make sense to me. But what does he do? Okay, there's a problem he has. He's created the problem. What's the solution to the problem? It's a sinful solution to the problem, and he manages to shift the blame onto somebody else. In June 1972, there were some men who were working to re-elect the President of the United States, and they broke into the Watergate Hotel, into Democratic National Committee headquarters, in order to get information from the Democrats, in order to use that information against the Democrats in the upcoming election. The break-in was bad enough. The solution to the problem, the cover-up, was worse. The cover-up resulted, for the first time in U.S. history, the resignation of a President of the United States and the conviction of an astounding 43 people. The solution to the problem was worse. And all along, the administration at that time blamed their problems on someone else or other people, especially their political enemies and especially the press. Or, worst of all, consider Nazi Germany. The Nazis blamed the problems of Germany on the Jews. What did they do with their problem? They conceived of and executed this awful, horrible plan to execute every single Jew living in Europe. And they had the temerity to call their solution the final solution. They shifted the blame. The problem is all somebody else. They come up with a sinful solution, this horrible, awful, sinful solution that wreaks all sorts of havoc. François Mauriac was a writer living in France at the time of World War II, and he heard about Jewish children who were being rounded up at a train station in Paris in order to be deported. He heard about this. He didn't see it firsthand. He just heard about it, and he was horrified. And for him, at that particular moment, the Enlightenment died. The Enlightenment was born in the 18th century in Europe of the hope that humanity could progress, could move forward through human reason and rationality and science. And at that moment, just hearing about what was happening to those children, for him, the Enlightenment died. Here's what he says. The dream which Western man conceived in the 18th century, which had grown stronger with the progress of enlightenment and the discoveries of science, this dream vanished finally for me before those trainloads of little children. And yet I was still thousands of miles away from thinking that they were to be fuel for the gas chamber and the crematory. He had no idea how bad it actually was for him when the Enlightenment died. Beware of solutions to the human problem that don't take sin into account. Beware of shallow solutions in a world where people conceive of and execute the so-called final solution. We need a solution that goes much deeper. We need a solution that goes into the human heart. Many today are still extolling the virtues of technology, and indeed, we have much to be thankful for concerning our technological advances. But technology, of course, can be used for good as well as for evil. The Holocaust proves that. With technology, you can build a city or you can bomb a city. With technology, you can heal a child or you can incinerate a child. I was using technology in the composition of this sermon. I was using the internet. I was using it, I think, for a good purpose. You may have a different opinion on that, depending on what you think of the sermon, but it was my intention to use technology for a good purpose. And as I was doing research, as I was doing a search, coming up on the list of results that I got on one particular search was this small, little, tiny, pornographic photo. I was attempting to use the internet for good. While I was doing that, someone else had already attempted to use it for evil and was tempting other people to use it for evil by clicking on that little image, because you know what sort of world that is going to open up once you click on that little image. No, I think we have to look elsewhere for a solution to the human problem. If people are using technology for evil, and they are, and they will, we have to look elsewhere. We might want to look at the last verse of the book of Judges, verse 25. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit, or literally what was right in his or her own eyes. Then the narrator here seems to be highlighting the need for a king. And as you look forward in biblical history from the point of Judges, you see that the next book is the book of Ruth, which tells us where David, the prototypical king of Israel, came from. And then we have 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, and ultimately we get to David, who is a man after God's own heart, who does right in God's eyes to a large extent. Nevertheless, he too has feet of clay. He too falls short. He too leaves Israel in a very difficult place by the time that he dies, so that Israel and the monarchy go into decline after his life. However, what did David do? He wrote Psalms. And in those Psalms, in some of those precious Psalms, he speaks of someone who is coming. He speaks of the Messiah who is coming. He is speaking of the Son of God who is coming. David himself was the apparent answer to the problem, but he knew that he wasn't the answer to the problem as going someplace else. He's looking someplace else in those Psalms. David was not the king that Israel needed. However, David was the poet that Israel needed. David is not the king we need. David is the poet we need, who shows us and points us forward to another solution. Long about what we call the first century, an angel appeared to a woman, a young virgin, and the Spirit came upon her, and she gave birth to a son. She gave birth to the Son of God. She gave birth to Jesus of Nazareth, who is called the Christ. The Israelites abducted hundreds of virgins and compounded the perversity in Israel. God, in infinite humility and tenderness, approaches a single virgin and gives her the opportunity to bring salvation to the world and overturn all perversity. Look what God does with a virgin. And to think, today, in our day, virginity is laughed at. People are made to feel ashamed because they are virgins. Look what God does with virginity. Those of you who are not yet married or have been married, just consider that. What can God do with you? You offer yourself to God. You save yourself for someone. God can do amazing and wondrous things in that regard. Look what he does with a virgin. Is our time all that different from the time of Judges? Well, we live in a certain insulated society here in the Silicon Valley. It's a little bit cozy in comparison to what's going on in the rest of the world. But you'd have to say, if you look at the rest of the world is a mess. Our world is a mess. If you look in your own hearts, you'd have to say, hey, you know what? That's pretty messy in there too. My heart is a mess. Mostly today, people do what is right in their own eyes, not what is right in God's eyes. We tend to weep for our loss, but not for our sin. We tend to blame others for our problems instead of seeing ourselves as part of the problem. And we conceive of sinful solutions that actually make the problem worse. What a mess. We need a king. We need the king. We need Jesus. We need the Christ. We need the Son of God. And if the virgin birth proves anything, it proves that God is willing to dive into the mess of this world. Where is God? Is he out there so distant that he doesn't do anything about anything? Does he look upon this mess and say, oh, too messy for me? No, the virgin birth proves that God gets into the mess with us. And you can identify with this perhaps most of all because you know your own heart, at least in part. You don't know it in full, but you know it in part. And you know that if you take a look in there, it's pretty messy. And what does Jesus say? I want to go there. I want to go to the messiest part. I want to go to the deepest part. I want to go to the place you don't even know about, where it's really, really messy, where all those hidden motivations are hanging out. I want to go there. I want to be with you there. That's what God does. And to me, this is one of the most encouraging things about the gospel. It is that Jesus wants to dwell with me in the mess. He wants to go in there. One of the paradoxes of the spiritual life oftentimes is the more you go, the more you realize how messy it is in there. I would like to think that, yeah, you follow Jesus and things are getting better. And perhaps that's true. But oftentimes what Jesus does is makes you aware of how messy it actually is to make you aware of how great it is what God actually does. And so I have grown increasingly appreciative of the presence of Jesus in my life, in the mess, as I've become more aware of the mess that my heart is. And yes, Jesus is saying, trust me, I'm working here. I'm working in hidden, unseen ways that you probably don't know about, and maybe one day you will, but trust me, I'm working on this mess, and I'm with you in this mess, and I want to be with you in this mess, and that, for me, is hope. That is encouragement, because I know, ultimately, Jesus is going to finish what he has started. Let him in. Let him in your heart. If you've never let him in your heart before, maybe you understand today a little bit of what the mess it is. You need a solution to that problem. Jesus wants to go into that mess. Open your heart, let him in. If you've already let him in, you probably need to let him in again. There are probably deeper regions that he wants to go into, and you need to open up your heart and let him go there. In fact, he's probably already there. You need to open your heart and realize in that deep, dark spot, he is already there bringing light. He is already there loving you in the deepest mess that you have. One day, of course, Jesus is going to finish what he has started in our hearts, in our world. He's going to make us beautiful. He's going to make this world beautiful. He's going to unite heaven and earth. He's going to bring about a new creation, the new Jerusalem in which righteousness dwells. He is going to clean up the mess in a way that transforms the mess into something absolutely stunning in our hearts and in our world. You may think that you need many things, but you need Jesus. He is the one necessary thing. He is the solution ultimately to the problem, and this solution to me sounds epic. Epic. Oh, that's next week.